All right, welcome to the Michael Slate Show. I'm your host, Michael Slate, and that is Let There Be Drums. And today, there's going to be a lot of drums because we got a powerhouse of a show for you. At the back end of the show, we're going to be talking with Terry Lilly, a marine biologist, and Dr. Thierry Work, a wildlife disease specialist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And we're going to be talking about an epidemic outbreak of cyanobacterial infections of Kauai's coral reefs, known as white coral disease. And this disease can destroy 100-year-old reefs in less than 8 weeks. So stay tuned for that one. You don't want to miss it. But opening the show up, I'm really pleased to welcome to the show Mikko Peled. He's the author of the book, The General Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And he's a voice that really needs to be heard in the world today. I can't emphasize that enough. He's the son of a renowned Israeli general, a man who was actually one of the architects of the Israeli state. And Mikko grew up in Jerusalem in the heart of the group that ruled Israel. There's a number of things that we'll talk with him about that changed him over the years, some particularly deep and heavy nodal points, snapped his head around and made him reexamine the unquestioning Zionism that he had grown up with and led him to eventually come out and condemn the Zionist state as an apartheid regime. Mikko, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you for this book. I'll start off with just saying that. It's an incredible book. And I wanted to start off with this just to sort of set things in motion. There's a point in the book towards the end where you say, the pain of knowing what I know is a pain so sharp that sitting around and doing nothing stopped being an option for me a long time ago. And as I read that, having gone through the whole book, it struck me just how sweeping and how deep that statement is. And I wanted people to know that, you know, as I mentioned, you were part of the ruling class in the Israeli state, and you'd made a remarkable transformation, and it was a long and complex journey. Can you give people a sense of who you were when you began that journey?
Yes, well, I was the son of a general. I was the nephew of all kinds of people who had high positions in the state. I mean, the state of Israel was part of my family. We had judges and cabinet ministers and my father, the general, and a president. And I mean, so this was our family. So the state of Israel was like a family. And while it was clear even to me then that, you know, we may have made mistakes, we may have not be perfect, but we were basically right and we held the moral high ground and so forth. And the myth of Israel was to me like the story of my family. And so that was where I came from. That was a very, very strong patriotic Zionist upbringing.
When you talk about the myth of Israel, what are you talking about?
I'm talking about the myth of the creation of the state of Israel. You know, looking at it today, it's clear to me that the worst act of terrorism that took place in the Middle East, or certainly one of the worst acts of terrorism, was the establishment of the state of Israel. It was established as a result of, or right after, a massive act of terrorism in which almost 1 million people were forced out of their homes. There were massacres and rapes and destruction by the Zionist movement, by the Zionist militia. But the story that we hear, the myth is that the United Nations parted the country and that we accepted it and we were a small minority and then the Arabs attacked us trying to destroy us and we held the high ground because we were morally right and we were smart and we were a little bit advanced because, you know, we're Jews. And, you know, my father was an officer in the Haganah, in the Zionist militia. And against all odds, like David against Goliath and the Maccabees against the Greeks and so on and so forth, we prevailed, and today, thank goodness, we have our state and we're strong and so on and so forth. So going from that to what I said earlier, the realization that the establishment of the state of Israel was an act of terrorism, it's a long road to cross, but that is the road that I had to cross to come to where I am today.
How much did finding out the truth about the history actually play? How much of a role did it play, and did it occur in stages, or was it like one big smack in the head?
No, it occurs over years. It occurred over stages. Thank goodness. I think I would have gone mad if it happened all at once. It's very painful. I mean, it's like discovering that you have a father who is a criminal or an alcoholic or a mass murderer or something, that somebody in your family is gravely, you know, deranged and you didn't know this. It's very, very painful. And I was very fortunate because the way it all began for me was I joined a Jewish-Palestinian dialogue group in San Diego. And I came from this place of, you know, being a kind of a liberal Zionist, a liberal Israeli. And in a very gracious and generous way, the Palestinian community or the Palestinians who were part of this group, it kind of led me through this realization that the story that I know to be true and hold very dear is actually not true. Nobody, you know, nobody sat there trying to accuse me of anything, or nobody tried to make me feel bad about anything. But everybody just very naturally told their stories. And that led me to go and investigate further, and then books by Israeli historians came out, Ilan Pape and several others, that kind of took a closer look and a new look, a fresh look at what happened in 1948. So I began reading them, and then I began traveling to the West Bank, and I started having friends, Palestinian friends. Many of them were prisoners. Then I learned about this whole thing that Israel has thousands of political prisoners. which of course we call terrorists, but turns out over 90% of them have not even been charged with violence, so they're not terrorists, not even attempted terrorists. So very gradually, and to this day, I mean, I'm still learning. The book, you know, the subtitle of the book is Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. My journey in Palestine is an ongoing journey in discovering new and tragic and beautiful things as well every single day.
You know, one of the things as you're talking, I keep thinking about the enormous impact that this kind of spinning out of the mythology actually being the basis for the entire society in a certain sense. You know, you think about that and it struck me, you know, that there's all kinds of things that that can lead to, including a very willful blinding of the people, self-blinding of people towards some of these massive atrocities and war crimes that go on. And this seemed to be something that is sort of endemic in Israeli society.
That's true. I mean, the story of the creation of the State of Israel, or the myth, I should say, is a big part of who you are as an Israeli. So when you let that go, there could be an identity crisis, and you have to take a really close look at who you are and where you stand. People still ask me, are you still Israeli? Are you still Jewish? Are you still this? Are you still that? And of course, I am. That's my identity. It's who I am. But it's very true what you're saying. I mean, the perpetuation of the myth through an education system. And it just so happens, my sister just came out with a book about the Israeli education system called Palestine and Israeli School Books, and it demonstrates that the Israeli education system is an inherently racist education system. It educates people to become racist. And one of the examples she gives are how the massacres are described, because there are several massacres that took place over the years that everybody talks about, and even the school books talk about them. But the way they describe them is that, for example, Deir Yassin that happened in 48 was a terrible thing. But thank goodness, because as a result of that, hundreds of thousands of Arabs left the country and we were able to establish a Jewish majority. So although the massacre itself is bad, the results were actually favorable. And that kind of is the more important part of the story. So it is blinding. And that's exactly how it is, that young Israelis can put on uniform one day and shoot innocent civilians, just like happened a couple of days ago in Hebron, where a young Israeli soldier, a woman soldier, shot to death a 17-year-old kid on his birthday. That's exactly the process that takes place.
We're talking with Miko Peled, the author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Now, Miko, I don't know if you're familiar with this short film, The One Family in Gaza by Jen Marlowe.
No, I'm not. I'd like to see it.
Yeah, well, it's very heavy because this tells the story of this family that suddenly heard some rumbling outside, and the daughter said, looked out the window and said, Mommy, there's soldiers and tanks outside. And they just got out of their house before it was just demolished. The roof caved in. It was bombed, all this stuff. And then as they're out there, their young son gets shot. And then the parents also get shot. And the story is how they have to watch as Israeli soldiers maniacally laugh and use his body over a period of hours as target practice. And you keep thinking about what is it that can actually warp somebody's thinking so much that this is an acceptable idea, but it's exactly that kind of indoctrination that you're talking about.
Yes, you know, this raises two issues. One is that if somebody was to describe the day in the life of a Palestinian to just anybody here in the United States, they wouldn't believe it. It's so horrible. I also just finished reading Susan Abulahawa's wonderful book, The Mornings in Jenin. And it's one of those books that's so full of pain and beauty that you just don't know what to do with yourself. But that is a reflection of Palestinian life. There's so much beauty and there's so much insanity. In terms of the Israelis, you know, it reminds me a little bit of criminals, you know, mafia people. Once you kill the first one, and once you torture your first victim, and once you murder the first child or the first innocent civilian or the first old woman or man, then it makes you crazy. And then you only become crazier and crazier unless somebody's there to hold your hand and take you through some kind of therapy. But that's exactly what is happening to Israeli soldiers. They are so full of insanity, they're so full of pain and confusion and hate that they can do these things, and they behave like sick people who need help.
Yeah, well, you know, one of the things too, though, is you look at this, and in the society in general, the fact that things like Sabra and Shatila can be accepted, or the fact that not just the history, because the history is easily, you can rewrite history, and as you say, your sister's book talks about that you can always get in there and rewrite history and talk about, well, you know, like in this country, well, you know, it was the industrious, hardworking, you know, honest settlers that came to this country, built this country, and had and faced these, you know, angry savages, and they had to be put in their place. And people buy into that, but it's very, very, very heavy today that when you're talking about a country that is, as you discovered, is actually part of the myth, is that it was somehow, it was formed and it was, you know, it was actually an act of history and it was a reclamation of you know, the past, and it was really bringing into being what was justly deserves to be. And, you know, you made the break to discover that, no, this in fact is not the case. But so many people will look at that and they'll think that's the case. And then they'll justify things like Sabra and Shatila. They'll justify things like the rampaging that you were talking about earlier in terms of how when Israel was first established through this theft of Palestinian lands and the forced dispersal of Palestinian people, that all gets accepted.
Yes, it gets accepted and it gets forgotten. So, you know, Sabra and Shatila was terrible, and then there was Jenin, and then Jenin was terrible, and there was Gaza, and then the first Gaza was horrible, and then there's, you know, and then people just move on with their lives because how much horror can you absorb, and what can you possibly do? People feel so helpless in the face of this monstrosity that is the state of Israel. And in terms of people supporting it, people come up to me sometimes and say, oh my goodness, are you really against the state of Israel? You know, what if people say? I said, of course I'm against the state of Israel. It's a values issue. It's not politics. Opposing Israel is not a question of politics, it's a question of values. Because if you accept and you support Israel, that means you also support a state that holds thousands and thousands of political prisoners, often without trial. It means that you support the killing of children, the theft of land, displacement of people, you support massacres, and you support ethnic cleansing. So, because it's a package deal. So if your values or your God or your religion or whatever the case may be directs you to support that, then that's a package deal, and this is the kind of person you are, and that's what you support. But that's where we part ways, because it's a values issue. I can't justify anything Israel does for any reason, certainly not for the existence of this absurd notion of a Jewish state. And I think it's really important for people to see that. It's a values issue. It comes down to whether you think you can justify killing a child or not. And if you can justify killing a child, then that's where we part ways.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Miko Peled, who's the author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. And it's a story of a man who went from being part of the ruling structures, the whole setup in Israel, to somebody who, as you just heard, you know, steadfastly stands against it on the question of values and morality and the reality that he learned is true. Now, Miko, you know, one of the things, as you're talking, you talked about ethnic cleansing in Israel. And in a way, there's this point about the double standard that you've talked about a lot that operates with the Zionist and with the Israeli state. But this ethnic cleansing is sort of one of these things that, you know, it's like touching the tiger's butt, you know, because the people will then turn around to you and say, don't tell me about ethnic cleansing. What about the Holocaust? You know, there's a whole thing where the combination of any criticism of Israel is equated to support for the Holocaust. What do you say to people when they bring issues like that up?
That they're full of crap, excuse me. You know, I was at the protest in L.A. Was last week against standing outside during the Friends of the IDF event. And we were standing outside and protesting, and there are many Jews. I think probably half the people there were Jewish. And there was an older gentleman, Holocaust survivor, who was a regular face in all these protests. And he and I had a conversation, and he told me why he comes to these protests and why he supports Palestine. And it's not uncommon for Holocaust survivors to abhor the notion of a Jewish state because it's a racist state, and I know of several that have tried to live there and saw how horrifying it was and couldn't stand it and leave. Another part of this story that I think is important for people to realize is that even after the Holocaust, even after all the death and destruction the Jews suffered in Europe, most Jews preferred not to go to Israel. You know, many Jews went back to Germany, they stayed in Europe, they came to America. Most Jews preferred not to go to Israel. Israel has got nothing to do with the Holocaust. It's a notion that was put together. It's an ideology that was put together by a small group of European Jews. And they claim to represent the world Jews, and they never have, and they never will. I mean, most Jews don't live there and never will live there. And in the very beginning, of course, they couldn't even get Jews to come, even after the Holocaust. So this trying to create this connection between Israel and the Holocaust is almost as absurd as trying to create the connection between Israel and, you know, the biblical days of King David and the ancient Hebrews, which is another absurd notion. And it just doesn't hold water, this argument that somehow being against Israel means you're anti-Semitic or you're Nazi or anything like that. But again, it goes back to the values, because, and I know that many people who criticize Israel are called anti-Semitic and get this kind of pushback. And the thing is, well, maybe I'm anti-Semitic if I don't support Israel, but if you support a state like Israel that is a racist state, that kills children, that takes away water from children because they're Arabs and gives it to other children because they're Jewish, or not to mention, again, the ethnic cleansing and the massacres and so forth, if you support that kind of a state, well, what does that make you? And I think this is kind of the next question that has to be asked. Well, if opposing Israel is anti-Semitic, then how horrific is it if you do support Israel? What does that make you? Because it's a racist state. It's a state that engages in terrorism. It has a military that is really nothing more than a glorified terrorist organization. And it's a country. It's a state that has been engaged in a cruel and brutal ethnic cleansing for almost seven decades. So what does that make somebody who supports that kind of a state?
Actually, that's a very good question, a very important question. We're talking with Mikko Peled, the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Now, Mikko, as you're talking, I keep thinking about, you've made a comparison, a very sharp comparison of Israel to apartheid South Africa. Let's talk about that a little bit.
Well, I think that, you know, people argue that it's not exactly South Africa, and of course it's not exactly. Desmond Tutu says that the conditions of Africans, of black Africans in South Africa, was never as bad as the situation as the Palestinian situation. And of course there are differences, other differences. But basically the way I think, the reason I think apartheid is appropriate is an appropriate comparison because Israel governs different parts of its population with different laws. So whereas I'm an Israeli Jew and I live in a democracy, I can speak my mind, I can come and go as I please. It's a democracy for me. Then there's another part of the population, about 1.5 million Palestinians who are citizens of the State of Israel, and there are about 30 laws in the Israel law books that discriminate against them specifically, and they live in an environment of racism and discrimination that is horrific, and not to mention neglect, horrific neglect by the state. And then you've got, and that's the second part, second population. The third population are the Palestinians who live in the West Bank and Gaza, and there are no laws at all that protect them. They have absolutely no rights, and they're completely at the mercy of the brutality of the Israeli security forces, the Israeli armed forces. But everybody is governed by the same government. Everybody is governed by the State of Israel. Everybody is governed by the Jewish state. And, of course, the only way to have a Jewish state in an Arab country where half the population is Arab, is not Jewish, then it is, of course, through this kind of a state, an apartheid racist state. But it is apartheid because they're governing different parts of the population under different laws. That's why I think that the comparison to apartheid is justified. I think where, in a good way, there's a difference is that when this ends, when Zionism falls, just like apartheid fell, then I think the Israelis and Palestinians are going to be in a far better position because you don't have that kind of a gap between the two societies. You don't have masses who are uneducated and you know, poverty-stricken. You have two societies that are highly educated. You know, even in Gaza, the literacy rates are over 90%, some of the highest in the world. You have doctors and teachers and social workers and engineers that are ready to go to work tomorrow. If the racist laws were lifted and the wall was taken down, then people could go to work the next day and you could have a functioning society and a functioning state where the two sides participate in every aspect of life equally. You could have that happen very quickly and you probably won't see the kind of sad story that is South Africa today with all the problems that it's having. So I think in that regard, the Israeli-Palestinian situation in terms of the future is promising to be a much brighter future.
You know, when you talk about this, I'm reminded I used to write a lot about South Africa and spent a lot of time there during the uprisings, the township uprisings in the 80s. And one of the things that I learned in the course of this, and it really has always stuck with me, you know, in terms of even in relation to, especially in relation to, in comparison to what's going on in Israel and the similarities between the Bantustan system there, which in fact did end up pushing a lot of the a lot of the African people into these Bantustans that had no economy, that were just, you know, overwhelmed and were, you know, sort of basically outdoor prisons, which is, you know, many people have described Gaza, for instance, as the largest outdoor concentration camp in the world. And I kept thinking about this as I was reading your book and thinking about what you're saying. And one of the things is that, you know, you look at this and Gabby Peterberg at UCLA, and he's written, he's like yourself, an ex, you know, Israeli army guy and all this stuff. And when I had him on my show a couple years ago, he said that one big difference between what went on in South Africa and what goes on in Israel now is that in South Africa, they actually needed the black people for labor. But in Israel, there's an idea that the Palestinians are not only not needed for labor, but they're not even recognized as a people. And when you look at it, you have a map in your book. When you look at the comparison between the map of the area pre-1948 or even at the beginning of 1948 and what it looks like and what's Palestine going up to today, and you can get a real sense of what this ethnic cleansing means in reality when you look at the, how diminished Palestine is to almost non-existent little spots on the map today.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, the Zionist notion is that, you know, they used to say a land without a people to a people without a land. They didn't mean that the land didn't have people in it. They all knew that the land was populated. They just meant it was the wrong people and they were insignificant and therefore they could be kicked out. And that's the idea. The idea is that the Arabs have invaded our land and we need to kick them out so that we can bring the Jewish people back, so to speak, to their historic homeland. So that's why it's an ongoing ethnic cleansing. They don't want them there. Israel brings hundreds of thousands of foreign labor workers from, you know, Eastern Europe and from Asia and from all kinds of places. but they won't employ Palestinians. They want to get rid of Palestinians. They need the Arabs to leave. That is the name of the game. Ethnic cleansing is a major portion, it's a major pillar of what the State of Israel is all about, of what Zionism is all about. Because, like I said, if you're trying to establish a Jewish state in a country that has been an Arab country for 1,500 years, where you have Arab names and Arab monuments and Arab traditions, and not to mention a Palestinian Arab population, then you have to get rid of the people, then you have to get rid of the monuments, and you have to change, and you have to create a new history. So they're making this ridiculous assumption, this ridiculous claim, that today's Israel, the Jews of today, are the descendants of the Hebrews who inhabited parts of that country some 3,000-4,000 years ago. And therefore, they have the right to return, which, of course, you wonder how they were even able to sell such an absurd proposition. But that's exactly the process. They want to get rid of the Arabs. They want to de-Arabize the country. And they want to, again, to create this mythical notion of a continuation of the Maccabees and King David and all that, which is absurd.
If you're just tuning in, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today with Miko Peled, the author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine. Now, one final question, Miko, and I wanted to ask you this because it's a theme that runs all the way through your book. The idea that you start referring to Israel / Palestine, and the idea that Israel actually is Palestine, and Palestine is Israel, and in particular that Israel is Palestine no matter how much they try to deny that. And you also make the point, though, that you came recently, or not recently, but I think actually it's a product of the whole journey that you went through. You came to a position which is fairly unique, I think, for an Israeli to actually take up, which is the idea that it's a one-state solution, that you need a state where people can live in equality with one another, that's a democratic secular state, and that's what you're advocating. And this is a fairly controversial position to take, even among the most liberal of Israeli people. Why do you do that, and why is it important?
Well, because Israel is Palestine. All of Israel is occupied Palestine. All Israeli cities and towns are settlements that are built illegally. So that's one point that has to be established. Number two, since this has been established, and today we have about 6.5 million Israelis living there and 5.5 million Palestinians living there, everybody being governed by the same government. So, in fact, Israel created one big Jewish state on the entire land, which is, of course, what they wanted to do to begin with. Now we have to think, okay, so where do we go from here? We have two nations living there, but you have a Jewish state, so half the population are disenfranchised and oppressed. So the one state is already there. It's just that it's a racist state. So the only way forward is for all of us who believe in justice and want to see peace to put our thoughts and our efforts together to remove the state of Israel, to remove Zionism from the equation, and to bring about a transformation that will create a real democracy, a democracy where Israelis and Palestinians can live in peace, can live as equals, can tap into their potential, and to create something better for everybody. And I see this as a very, very, something that's going to happen very, a lot sooner than most people think, and a very realistic and practical solution to this conflict.
All right, Miko, and I'm just going to remind people, I'm going to leave people with this quote from you again. If you knew what I know, if you saw what I saw, you would do the same. The pain of knowing what I know is a pain so sharp that sitting around and doing nothing stopped being an option for me a long time ago. Miko Peled, author of The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
Okay, talk to you again soon, man. Take care.
Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye now. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've just been talking with Miko Peled. Miko's the author of the book, The General's Son, Journey of an Israeli in Palestine, and it's a book about the transformation of a man who went from being a rabid Zionist, a member of the ruling and one of the founding families in Israel, to a person who now talks about Israel being an apartheid state and wholeheartedly supports the struggle of the Palestinian people. We're going to take a quick musical break, and when we come back, we're going to be talking with a marine biologist and a wildlife disease specialist in Hawaii about murder on the north shore of Kauai. So stay tuned. You don't want to miss this one. We'll be right back. Welcome back. That was Dr. Lonnie Smith with Sweet Dreams.
In Hawaii, a coral reef infection has biologists alarmed. A very mysterious growth has been spreading under the waters of Hanalei Bay and elsewhere on Kauai's north shore. It's a disease, and it's killing all the coral that it strikes, and scientists have not yet found a way to stop it. And I guess there's actually a question of whether it can be stopped. Joining us today to talk about all this is Terry Lilly, who's a biologist, and Dr. Terry Work, who is works with the he's a wildlife disease specialist for the U.S. Geological Survey's Honolulu Field Office. Terry, Dr. Work, welcome to the show.
All righty, thank you.
Okay, let me start with you, Terry. You were one of the people who actually first saw the manifestations of this disease, right? What did you see and how did you find it?
Actually, I found it by accident. I've been doing underwater DVD series in California for about 10 years, educational movies. And then when I moved to Hawaii, I've been doing an underwater series about Hawaiian reef fish. And so I've got about 1,000 hours scuba diving throughout the Hawaiian Islands. And I live in Hanalei in Kauai. And about 2 years ago, I noticed this very strange discoloration of the coral, the rice corals, and a very unusual kind of white and or yellow blotches that were growing across the coral. I'd never seen this before, didn't know what it was. And then about in January of this year, Dr. Greta Abbey from the University of Hawaii sent out an alert to divers and biologists like myself saying that she had discovered this new type of coral disease and everyone needs to be on the lookout for it. And I called her immediately when I got her email and said, Greta, you know, I think I'm seeing this stuff on the north shore of Kauai. And sure enough, I sent her pictures and she verified it. And that's how I originally discovered it about a little over a year ago.
And when you looked at it, I mean, what did you think of what it was? I mean, did you recognize it as a disease or what did you think?
No, I mean, put it this way. I've spent 50 years underwater and been in the water my entire lifetime and have studied reefs all around the world. And I've never seen anything on a coral that even remotely looked like this. At first, I only found a few infected corals along the North Shore, maybe 100 at 60 or so different dive sites. And then all of a sudden, the start of summer, this stuff spread to tens of thousands of corals everywhere. It's blanketed a lot of the North Shore of Kauai. So it was the alarming part was not necessarily the discoloration of the coral, but how fast this stuff was spreading across the surface of the coral and killing it. It was like, I've had a lot of people, when they look at my pictures, they say it looks like someone poured battery acid on the coral.
Dr. Work, you described this as an epidemic, and that's a fairly alarming description. Can you talk about why and what that means?
Yeah, so what we do is we work for a government agency, and we provide technical assistance to the public and state and government agencies on wildlife diseases. So when people report mortality events to us, we go out and investigate them, and that's how we got hooked up with Terry. He reported this to us, and we went out and did a field investigation. And really, an epidemic is an unusual outbreak of a disease in multiple places. And I was very comfortable calling it an epidemic based on several pieces of evidence. First of all, we have very good baseline data over 10 years on causes of death in corals in the Hawaiian archipelago. And this particular disease that we think is caused by cyanobacterium doesn't even register on our radar screen or hardly ever did until this event in Kauai this year. So that was the first thing. The second thing is that this disease was affecting mainly two species of corals, and the lesions that were presenting grossly were very similar among all the corals we were seeing, both at the gross level and also on microscopy. There was very consistent presentation. The third reason why we thought this was an epidemic is that the percent of corals affected was very high based on historical standards. And then the fourth piece of evidence was that it was in multiple places. So in summary, the presence of a disease showing consistent lesions at high prevalence across many different, or at least two different places widely spaced apart on the north shore of Kauai merited the event of being called an epidemic. I'm very comfortable with that assessment.
Okay, now when you describe something as an epidemic, in terms of how it would spread, does, you know, like you think I guess maybe I'm locked into this kind of idea of, okay, an epidemic, like somebody sneezes and you pass it along, or you touch something and your hands aren't clean and it just spreads one person to one person or multiplies out. How does it spread among corals?
Well, that's the $64,000 question. We don't really know. All we know right now is we've identified this organism associated with these lesions in these corals. But how it spreads, what's driving it in the ecosystem, those are all questions we don't have an answer to yet.
And Michael,
yes.
Furthermore, like I said, Terry and I have been working on this virtually every day back and forth for months now, and we go over and over and over all kinds of possible scenarios. But when I first discovered this stuff, I found it at two locations. Those locations are 15 miles apart from each other. And we thought maybe that there was a vector or some kind of animal spreading this disease. But in a three-month period of time, this disease showed up at over 60 of my dive sites, over 30 miles of coastline, all at the same time, literally within weeks. So that kind of threw out the door that this stuff started at one spot and spread throughout the ecosystem along the North Shore. And now I feel pretty comfortable that this bacteria may be a part of the ecosystem in a natural way, but something has caused the entire North Shore of Kauai, the reef system, to lose its resistance or be damaged in a certain way that this bacteria can now take over the corals, because it simply showed up in too many corals at the same time over a very wide stretch of coastline to have been spreading from one individual area.
Mm-hmm. Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Terry Lilly. He's a biologist and an underwater videographer, and also Dr. Terry Work, who is a wildlife disease specialist for the U.S. Geological Survey's Honolulu office. All right, well, let's pursue this a little bit more. Dr. Work, one of the things about the point about this disease was first, well, let me ask you this first. What exactly, you mentioned a cyanobacterial pathogen, cyanobacterium. What is that, and how does that function?
Well, a cyanobacterium is a type of algae, actually. It's a type of microscopic algae. So basically, it's an animal with little cells, and it photosynthesizes just like an algae. It's just microscopic. And there's many, many different types of cyanobacteria, and this particular type just seems to be infecting the coral and eating coral tissue. So not all cyanobacteria eat corals. There's other species that just grow on the reefs and form tufts, like little plant, plant-like tufts. And there's other cyanobacteria that bloom in freshwater bodies. It's just that this particular organism seems to be eating coral tissue for whatever reason.
Now, this organism, you've identified the organism. Is it something that you think is new to the area there?
Well, I don't think so. Well, I mean, we know we have documentation of it in Hanalei Bay in 2009. So this is one of the things that we have a historical timeline, in the sense that we've looked at tissues in corals since 2001, and it did pop up in Hanalei Bay in 2009. So it was at least in Kauai that far back. Now, maybe further back, I don't know, because we don't have samples before then.
Now, Terry, tell me this. In your just visually and what you've studied, again, tell people again just how rapidly, how extensive is this spreading? How rapidly is it spreading? I mean, what's the danger?
Put it this way, it's sickening. It's the best thing I can possibly say. Many of these corals at my dive sites, like I said, I've got over 1,000 hours underwater diving in Kauai, and probably now up to maybe 200 different dive sites, and I'm finding this bacterial infection at every dive site. And so you're looking at some of these corals that are 10, 20, 30, maybe up to 50 years old. And these corals are a light tan in color or have a green tint to them or a pink tint. They're very, very, very beautiful. And I've got hundreds of hours of video of all the cool creatures that live, in and amongst these corals. And when I first started seeing this stuff, again, it looked like a white area battery acid with a black rim around it, really gross looking, that spreads across the coral. Well, at first we thought, boy, maybe this stuff's spreading at about a centimeter a month or something, But we went back over and over and measured the spread rate, and it was growing at an inch or two a week So it was killing 30, 40-year-old corals in a matter of 6 to 8 weeks. I literally have video now of over 3,000 corals since the start of summer at my dive sites that are completely killed by this stuff. So you can see it 30 yards away if the water's clear. Mm-hmm. I mean, it stands out like a sore thumb, but it spreads so fast that it's almost kind of scary. You go back out to the same spots and see it all over the place when it wasn't there 2 months earlier. So I'm incredibly alarmed, not because of a disease specifically. There's lots of diseases in nature. But I've been all around the world studying wildlife. I've never seen any disease that spreads so fast in a large given area. And that's what really led me to be very appreciative of Dr. Work and Dr. Abbey coming over and doing the hardcore science on this stuff, because that's what it's going to take now to figure it out.
Mm-hmm. Dr. Work, following up on that, corals actually have, you would think they would have a certain immunity to other things that are native to the part of the ocean that they're in or whatever. What is it that actually, are they losing their immunity, and what's causing that?
Well, you know, when you look at any infectious disease, whether it be in a coral or a human, that infectious agent has to overcome the host immune response in some way in order to make the infection and the disease happen. So, I mean, technically, all diseases are some way of the organism overcoming the host immune system. In the case of the corals, you know, again, we know very little about this disease, but corals do have an immune system. They do have mechanisms to defend against things like bacteria and other pathogens. They have a mucus layer that they shed to shed off things. They have cells. They have immune cells in their tissues to fight off infections, and they produce things like chemicals that will kill bacteria and other pathogens. So, yes, they clearly have a functional immune system. But when you look at the reefs, at least the two reefs that we looked at, they were pretty degraded. There was a lot of sedimentation in the water. There was a lot of algal overgrowth. So it was not the healthiest ecosystems for corals to be existing. So one, it's hard not to conclude that there had to be some sort of environmental component. And every disease does have some sort of environmental component to it. But again, what all those factors are, that's going to require additional research.
And one thing, too, that's really interesting to note here, so people that come to Kauai can put this in perspective, that I've done hundreds and hundreds of scuba dives on the south shore of Kauai, and I have not found this disease. So it's spreading all along the north shore. It's not yet spreading on the south shore. I've also done hundreds of dives throughout Oahu, Maui, and the Big Island. And other than in Kaneohe Bay on Oahu, I've not seen this disease hardly anywhere else in the Hawaiian Islands. So there's something specifically about the North Shore of Kauai that seems to be degrading the reefs. And we've been dealing with in Kauai here for many years the lack of law enforcement under the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. And there's been a lot of people that have been digging in the wetlands and releasing a lot of toxins and mud out into the oceans. So we have other environmental problems that are, in my opinion, catastrophes happening on the north shore of Kauai that happen to relate, we don't know if they're directly related, but relate in time with the bloom of this disease.
Let me remind listeners once again that you're tuned into the Michael Slate Show, and we're talking today about a mysterious disease caused by a cyanobacterium in the north shore of Kauai that's destroying the coral reefs there. And we're talking with Terry Lilly, a biologist and underwater videographer, and Dr. Terry Work, who is a wildlife disease specialist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Honolulu office. Now, Dr. Work, following up on what Terry was just saying, in a report that you were one of the co-authors, I think, or at least were listed, your name was listed on the report, you talk about, and you just referred to this, you talk about that disease emerges from a complex interplay of host, agent, and environment. Let's talk about what does that mean in relation to this?
Well, okay, so, I mean, when you look at animal populations, you know, there's a homeostasis that occurs where host, you know, when you have a disease outbreak in an animal population, what happens is there's been a confluence of events where a host, an agent, have interacted in the environment to cause that disease. So, for example, human AIDS. The way human AIDS originally occurred is you had this virus circulating in chimpanzees or in primates in Africa, and somehow that virus was able to adapt and jump into humans. And then with behavioral traits that were conducive for humans to transmit the virus, that's how this disease propagated throughout the population. So it's really, you need to have a whole confluence of events come together for these disease events to occur in animal populations. So in the case of Kauai, we've had something come together where the environmental conditions have permitted this cyanobacterium to take off in the coral populations. And the question now is to try to understand the mechanisms that allowed this to occur. What is it that's driving the cyanobacterium to kill these corals? Why is it that only two species of corals were mainly affected and not really so many other species? Those are all questions that we need to start answering to try to understand the management of that disease. But you're absolutely right that, you know, in any disease events, you have to have these three things come together in the right combination, host, agent, environment, in order for this disease to occur.
Now, Terry, you mentioned the point about actually, you know, implying pollution and things coming, you know, through basically human-caused factors that would play into this that might be working in conjunction with other things to actually bring this, you know, this situation with this cyanobacteria and the corals into play. You know, what do you think, when you talk about that, is that what you view as either, you know, a major factor or even other things? I mean, I like to talk a little bit about what people know about global warming, you know, the impact of that, the acidification of the oceans.
Well, sure. I mean, but Michael, you're raising incredibly good questions, and we've been going over this. I do a lot of investigative biology, and I've done that for years and years and years to try to figure out what's happening, what is a normal occurrence, what's not a normal occurrence. We have, with rising sea levels, changing ultraviolet light hitting the reef, rising acid levels, all of these things are stressing reefs worldwide. We know that. Dr. Greta Abbey and Therry have been all around the planet studying coral reefs, and they have the ability to, you know, take data from many places in the world and extrapolate that to maybe what's going on in Kauai. So our reefs are stressed out. That's the bottom line. The way I look at it is kind of like if you smoke cigarettes and you drink alcohol and you have a terrible diet and all of a sudden the doctor says you have cancer, well, it's probably time to start taking better care of yourself or you're going to die of the cancer. So our reefs are stressed. We have to take better care of them right now than at any point in time, I believe, in the history of human beings on this planet. So when I see in video people digging in the river, releasing tons of mud, we even did testing on some of the mud and found exorbitant high amounts of heavy metals, high bacterial levels. So I've actually documented with HD video, time, date, and GPS some really horrific pollution going into the ocean on the north shore of Kauai. Now, is that directly related to the spreading of this disease? Well, I think guys like, you know, Dr. Work are going to be able to answer that question down the road. I surely can't answer that right now. But in a holistic way, I saw this stuff spread over the whole North Shore. I alerted local politicians and many of the government agencies about it a year ago, and they all ignored it. And back when there wasn't much of it on the reefs, now there's a lot of it, and some of the people are coming around and saying, okay, now, wow, maybe we better look at it. I'm like a heavy-duty advocate to prevention of these problems, that we need to be monitoring our reefs all over Hawaii on a daily basis, so therefore, when this stuff shows up, it can be nipped in the butt, so to speak, before it gets out of control. It's also one of the reasons why we've developed a web page, and I have these beautiful high-definition underwater movies showing what this disease looks like, showing the spread rate, interviews with Dr. Work and Greta Abbey. So other divers, surfers, snorkelers, and biologists throughout Hawaii, if they see something like this starting to happen, then they can report it and we can get a jump on it. We've waited way too long to get a jump on this stuff, and that's kind of, to me, not right. We should take better care of our ocean. We should study our reefs every single day, even when they're healthy, so when things crop up, we can nip it right there and try to find out what's going on. Now we got a major problem that's going to be a lot more difficult to figure out because we waited too long.
All right. Let me again remind listeners that we're talking with Terry Lilly, a biologist and underwater videographer based in Kauai, and Dr. Terry Work, a wildlife disease specialist with the U.S. Geological Survey. And we're talking about the disease that's attacking and killing the coral reefs in Kauai, off of the north shore of Kauai. Now, Dr. Work, back to you for a minute. What do you think about, you know, there's been a lot of reports that have come up in relation to the oceans, most specifically in relation to the acidification of the oceans and its impact on, you know, shellfish, as they found in Monterey recently. But the whole idea that the oceans are actually, if this is not reversed, there's actually been a lot of talk about this is actually a direct factor, one of the big factors that must combine with other environmental factors and other things to actually cause things like the death of these coral reefs. What do you think about that?
Well, I mean, when you're looking at animal diseases and disease management, obviously the better the conditions are in the environment, the more resilient the animals will be. So again, you can take the analogy of humans. You know, when in the Middle Ages, we used to live among open sewer pits, and we had a lot of people dying from childhood diarrheal diseases and parasitic diseases. And once we invented the toilet, we invented clean water and had clean water and sanitation, this was a great boon to public health. And that's, you know, nobody can argue with that with humans. And I think the same applies with corals. So you're right, we have all these issues with corals. We have global warming, we have ocean acidification, but we also have more localized insults. We have overfishing, we have sediment inputs in the coral reefs, we have pollutants that come out from watersheds, and then we have these diseases that occur. And so, you know, because we don't know enough about these diseases yet to manage them, one of the strategies we can do is what can we immediately do to reduce the impacts that we're having on coral reefs? Well, we're not going to do anything with global warming and ocean acidification anytime soon. That's a global problem we can't address immediately, but we can address the more localized insults on reefs, like runoff, sedimentation, and overfishing. These things are things that can be addressed locally in the near term. And so my argument is, why don't we start addressing some of these existing problems that we know have been documenting to be adversely affecting reefs elsewhere in the world? We can address them, and so we should at least try to start simple and address those immediate issues that we can have a handle on right now. And anything we do may not stop the disease immediately, but it sure will help the coral recover in long term and make it more resilient.
All right. Now, Terry, I'm going to go to you, and then I'll come back to Dr. Work. And this is a question I want both of you to speak to.
Yeah.
What is the impact, the actual impact of the death of coral reefs?
Boy, it's, for me, that is probably my specialty more than anything, because I've been a surfer since I was 3 years old. I've started spearfishing as a little kid from 3 years old. I'm 59 now. And I've been a diver my entire lifetime. And I just got done with an underwater movie series called The World's Guide to Hawaiian Reef Fish. And when you see the corals dying, I know at many of these places, and I'll get a little anthropomorphic maybe, but that's who I am. I know the individual creatures that live in these corals. I know the butterfly fish, Kikakapu, that actually eats the healthy coral polyp. I know the little tobies that are eating the diseased coral, and a lot of them look like they're dying from some type of bad disease. You kill the corals, you're also killing the beautiful butterfly fish. We have other fish that are called pilikoa, which means stick to coral. They're a hawkfish, and they actually live on top of the coral and hide in it for protection. The Hawaiian dasylus, a native fish we have here in Hawaii, hides in the live coral for protection. When people come to Kauai here and they see beautiful fish, all of those fish need to have a healthy coral reef to live. So it's not killing corals, you're killing the entire ocean ecosystem. And I say this all the time in my talks. I say, when you're sick, a human being is sick, you can't just study your foot, your toe, your arm, or your ear. You have to study the whole human body to see why the human body is sick. And I'll just throw out one fact that I find incredibly disgusting with mankind on this planet, is that the planet, the ocean, is 79% or so of the surface space on the entire Earth. But we spend less than 1% of our environmental studies on the ocean. So 99% of the money is spent on studying the land, but the ocean is 79% of our globe. It produces a lion's share of the oxygen that we breathe. It produces our food and enjoyment. So the Earth is connected. Humans are connected directly with the coral reef. If it dies, it's going to lead to our death. And I want people to finally wake up to we need to start studying the ocean on a day-by-day basis way better than we are right now. We're not talking about just a coral reef dying. It's way beyond that.
Let me remind listeners that you're tuned into The Michael Slate Show, and today we're talking with Terry Lilly. He's a biologist and an underwater videographer, and also Dr. Terry Work, who is a wildlife disease specialist for the U.S. Geological Survey's Honolulu office. All right, let me ask Dr. Work the same question. Taking off of what Terry's just been saying, Dr. Work, what's your opinion? What do coral reefs do, actually? What do they do for the, you know, what will we be missing?
Well, corals do above and beyond just the aesthetic of having a coral reef. Coral reefs actually provide quite a few important services to mankind. I mean, if you look at tropical countries, we have a lot of fisheries that depend on healthy coral reefs because these corals provide nurseries for fish that eventually migrate to the pelagic environment and provide a source of fisheries. So just economically, if you lose your corals, you get collapse of fisheries. The other issue is just, you know, tourism. I mean, Hawaii banks itself as a tourism destination. A lot of people come to Hawaii to look at our corals. Well, if we have dead corals everywhere, that's not terribly attractive from an economic standpoint and from marketing of tourism. Corals also play a very important role in providing barriers for coastal protection. For example, if you recall the tsunami in Phuket that occurred, I think, a few years ago in Thailand, where they had this big tidal wave that washed in the shore, they found that in areas where the coral reefs were degraded, the tidal wave went way further inshore than where the reefs were intact, because they basically provide coastal armor to protect coastal communities. So that's a very important ecosystem service that benefits mankind directly. And finally, coral reefs do provide a potential source of pharmaceuticals. There's many organisms that are being explored that are being used for potential anti-cancer drugs and other drugs that could benefit the pharmaceutical industry. So among many levels, economically, corals can be very valuable, and this is why we have a vested interest in trying to protect them, let alone just the aesthetic appeal that if you lose coral reefs, you basically, it's analogous to losing a rainforest with all the species that are associated with that rainforest. So, you know, those are all very good reasons to try to maintain coral reefs.
Absolutely. And my last question, and I'll talk to you first, and then we'll go over to Terry. Is it too late? I mean, I look, and when I was researching around this interview, and when things that I've read over the past few years, the question of, you know, you look at things like what's happened to the coral reefs in the Caribbean, in Florida. Is it too late now?
Well, that's the thing. We don't want to repeat what's happened in the Caribbean. I mean, in the Caribbean, what happened is in the 1980s, they lost urchins, then which was a major grazer on the reefs. Then you had algal overgrowth on the reefs. Then you had disease happen on the reefs. And now they're in a situation where they've lost over 80% of their coral cover in the Caribbean. We're nowhere near that situation in the Pacific, first of all. And second of all, most of the corals under U.S. jurisdiction are in the Pacific Islands. So we really have a chance here to get it right. And you know, we've done some things right in the sense that we're, you know, applying some new tools to try to understand coral health. So I don't think it's hopeless at all. And I think if we buckle down and address the issues one by one and compartmentalize the problems and address each one as they come, I think we have a chance to recover these corals. I mean, these animals can be remarkably resilient and resistant. We just need to give them a helping hand.
What do you think is the main thing standing in the way?
Political will.
All right. Terry?
I agree.
Yeah, go ahead.
I mean, I just couldn't agree with you more. I go out and do night movies out on the North Shore of Kauai, and I watch the corals spawn at nighttime on a full moon. And corals have the ability to reproduce themselves in a very, very rapid rate. They grow slowly, but they can reproduce themselves in a very rapid rate. We are easily smart enough and intelligent enough to reverse this problem that's going on the North Shore of Kauai. I'm absolutely 100% convinced of that, but we need to have more people and some money and, like Dr. Work says, political will. I've been reporting this stuff to the politicians, all of them, everyone. I'm not going to mention names. Every one of the top politicians in the island of Hawaii, I've sent emails about this disease to for the last year, year and a half. Not one of them has even bothered to respond to me until the article came out in the LA Times. So we can fix the problem. We're smart enough. These corals can come back. If we wait too long, we're going to be in trouble. We need to really jump on it right now.
All right, Terry Lilly, Dr. Terry Work, thank you both very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you for your time.
Okay, talk to you again soon. Stay in touch so we can follow up on this. All right?
All right, aloha.
Okay, take care now. Bye. All right, you're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host, Michael Slate, and we've been talking with Terry Lilly, a biologist and underwater videographer, and Dr. Terry Work, a wildlife disease specialist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Honolulu office. And we've been talking about the really intense and very troubling and alarming situation with the coral reefs in the North Shore of Kauai. And they indicate there's a major assault going on. They're being attacked by a disease, and it's in pretty bad shape. Very alarming thing. So the end of the coral reefs will definitely impact the entire world. All right, well, that brings us to the end of yet another show. And thinking back on the opening of today's show, there was something I wanted to leave you with, a thought I wanted to leave you with, and that's from Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party. And that is, after the Holocaust, the worst thing that has happened to Jewish people is the State of Israel. You're listening to The Michael Slate Show, and I'm your host and producer, Michael Slate. I want to thank my board op today, Teddy Robinson, my assistant producer, Henry Carson, and all of you for tuning in. If you want to write to me, you can at michaelslate@redfuture.com. Again, that's michaelslate@redfuture.com. We're going to go out now with Ought to Know Better from Ivan Neville and Dumpster Funk. Check this out.
No more lies. Retire. Devil's emotion caught in the act. In the name of freedom, they stabbed us in the back.